I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is shifting the focus from foreign to domestic policy today with a look at how to create jobs. With the nation's unemployment rate expected to remain above 10% for the time being, the president is holding what's billed as a job summit today, talking job creation with more than 100 corporate executives and business leaders. Tomorrow, he begins a tour of the country to hear directly from people about the economy. His first stop is in Allentown, Pennsylvania at Allentown Metalworks. It's a steel manufacturing company with 65 employees. Jim Gallagher is the CEO there. He bought the company in June of 2008 when it was in foreclosure. And Jim, first of all, the $800 billion federal stimulus package was supposed to help companies like yours, did it?
We've seen some, but certainly not at the rate or the pace that we had hoped for.
So are you disappointed then with the way the stimulus package has worked out for your business?
I'm disappointed, as everybody else in the United States is probably today, with the state of the economy. Whether the stimulus package has contributed to that or helped it, I'm not smart enough to answer that question.
What do you plan to show the president when he comes to visit tomorrow?
Well, we are the occupants of a almost 100-year-old, 300,000-square-foot manufacturing facility on 19 acres. So we can't show him everything. And what we intend to do is to give him at least a snapshot of our machining capabilities, which are extensive, and to introduce him to how we go about welding, fitting, and fabricating these major components. Hopefully from that experience, he can get a feel for the quality and the really professional capabilities of this group.
And then what do you hope that he does once he sees some of those things and hears from your workers and understands what Allentown Metalworks is capable of?
What I would, if the president asks, I'm not about to volunteer any ideas to the president, but if he asks, in my mind, what could be helpful is the commissioning of a group to study the United States in general manufacturing and industrial capabilities and developing a position as to how much of the day-to-day national economy should be comprised of manufacturing. Certainly over the past 40 years, the manufacturing capabilities of the United States have diminished. They've gone overseas, whether it be China or Mexico or Eastern Europe.
If it is less expensive for folks to get products like the one you produce in Allentown in places like China or Mexico or Eastern Europe, then why not just do that and focus on other areas? Why should the U.S. focus on our manufacturing capability?
Well, I think it's intuitively incorrect for us to be a nation of either investment bankers or waiters in restaurants. There's got to be a balance in what our economy revolves around. There's no question in my mind that from a quality point of view, we can outcompete most of the rest of the world.
What are the advantages that you think those other countries have that make it harder for you?
We've got one very large piece of equipment, which is called a vertical boring mill that we use to form precision, very heavy pieces of equipment. It's old. It's 89 years old, as a matter of fact. Now, we've upgraded it, but a similar piece of equipment in a Chinese plant is brand new. And whether they've provided the funding for the equipment, the funding for the training of the workers, or whatever funding, clearly there's been an aspect of government support for those businesses being started.
Your business does, what, about $10 million a year?
We're doing a little bit less than that right now.
Where do you think your company will be, say, a year from now?
A year from now, I would expect our revenue to double. And it would double again in the next 3 to 5 years.
And how are you going to be able to do that?
Well, what we need to do is attract quality people, provide them with training, get them certified, which, believe it or not, is an essential part of what we do from a welding point of view, get them trained up on equipment that we need to upgrade in some cases, buy some new equipment. All of those things put together will allow us to expand exponentially.
Can you do that without help from the federal government?
It would certainly be easier. And if we're part of what the federal, the state, or the local government decides is a critical component in the resurgence of the economy, then I would expect that we'd participate. And I think that with the proper investment in people, in training, and in the upgrading of our equipment, the U.S., and Allentown in particular, can become competitive on all levels. The potential still exists.
Jim Gallagher, CEO of Allentown Metalworks. President Obama will visit his steel manufacturing company tomorrow. Jim, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
In the current edition of The Atlantic magazine, journalist Hannah Rosen asks a provocative question. Did a type of Christianity known as the prosperity gospel help cause the economic crash? Her story features evangelical pastor Fernando Garay, a former drug dealer turned mortgage loan officer turned pastor of a mostly Latino church in Virginia that's grown quickly. Here's a sample of a recent sermon.
In the mighty name of Jesus. God says you're a wealthy woman, so act like it. In the mighty name of Jesus. In the mighty name of Jesus.
Garay prays for blessings in his parishioners' bank accounts, and he tells them that God will not let them be without a house. Rosen says that America's churches reflect broader shifts in our culture, and so she asks, what's the message behind Garay's church, Casa del Padre, and did churches like it help pump air into the housing bubble? Well, Hannah Rosen, contributing editor for The Atlantic, joins us from the magazine's radio studio. And Hannah, tell us more about Fernando Garay and his church.
It's an incredibly interesting place because he was both a loan officer during the boom years and he's a prosperity preacher. So I felt like he was at the center of this, you know, intersecting universes that I was trying to write about. And it's mostly an immigrant church. It's very new immigrants. They sort of range from working class to kind of really, really struggling. And the message he tells them is that if they are faithful and they commit to God, then God will reward them with very specific riches, material success, that is. And I think for many of them, it gives them a reason to hang on. It gives them a sense that they're part of the American dream, that they're not really marginalized. But it also creates this other situation where, you know, they just kind of take these risks that they really shouldn't take, like buy a house that they can't afford, buy a car that they can't afford, you know, start a business they can't really afford to start, which is the situation that many Americans went through over the last 10, 15 years.
What about tithing in his church?
Tithing is an incredibly central part of the prosperity gospel, where you're supposed to give 10% of your income, and they're pretty strict about the 10%. And the parishioners really do talk about it in this very direct way. If I give 10% faithfully, I will get it back. And you're talking about people who don't make a lot of money. So it's kind of amazing that they're committed in this way.
What made you think that there was a connection, to begin with, that there was a connection between these types of churches that preach the prosperity gospel, if you will, and the economic crash?
Well, it was actually thanks to a great radio program that I was listening to in which they were interviewing people who had taken out loans, which they clearly couldn't afford. And it was kind of amazing to me, like, where did people think that the money was going to come from? It seemed such a magical thinking about money. And having written about religion for a large part of my career, it suddenly made the connection in my head. Well, this is how people talk about money in prosperity churches. And so that connection became clear to me. And then I'm used to thinking of prosperity churches from the sort of Jim Baker televangelist scandal era of the 80s. But then I did some research and realized that, in fact, the prosperity gospel has become much more mainstream over these last 10 years and become, you know, one of the fastest growing theologies, not just in America, but worldwide. So then the connection was really sealed for me.
So tell us about some of the big names that we might recognize aside from Fernando Garay.
Joel Osteen is the biggest. I mean, he's got a new bestseller now, Your Best Life Now. He runs the biggest mega church in America. And he's a very popular self-help preacher. He's on Larry King. He's on television all the time. And in his book, you'll find, particularly his book that was written in the 90s, you know, the stories will be about looking for a bigger house. And that will be a sign of faith. And there's, you know, there's a couple of examples of people in his book who, you know, looked at a big house and said, I really can't afford that, honey. You know, their wife really wanted it. And that person is described as a spiritual failure. And the spiritual success is someone who believes that he, usually he, but sometimes she, should really grasp and take the leap of faith.
Hannah, I'm wondering how that kind of positive thinking is different, or is it at all, from, you know, books like The Secret or you know, other sort of self-help positive thinking books, maybe even Deepak Chopra. You know, there's always been this sort of, if you think positively, it's better for you and good things will happen to you. How is this different?
They're extremely related. One of the great theological criticisms of the prosperity gospel, I mean, there's the central one, which is that Jesus talked more about the poor and doing good works than he did about making you rich. So that's the sort of obvious criticism. But the second is that this isn't really a religious movement at all, that this comes from an American movement called New Thought and the power of positive thinking. You know, Norman Vincent Peale was a religious man himself. And the idea that you have the power to change your own circumstances, that within you, just in your mind, you know, and this is what The Secret is about, you can really make things happen even if the circumstances don't look right. So, you know, that is a really strong element of the prosperity gospel. And it's been both sort of secular and religious in American culture, but it's something that became really strong in the post-war era after World War II, when people started to think that the middle class also could have access to luxuries. And in that era, it was mostly about cars.
But isn't it almost the American story as well? It's our whole rags to riches belief, and many times the whole view of the American dream to a certain degree.
It's kind of like the American dream on speed, I would say. I mean, if you read a lot of the early prosperity preachers, they're these unbelievably flamboyant guys. You know, they really just like furs and gold, and I mean, they just like would grab the American dream. And so it's less an idea of the sort of early Protestant virtue, you know, that there's providence and that you will work hard and the good will be rewarded. It doesn't have that kind of Calvinist element to it of kind of virtue and hard work. It's kind of more of a grabby thing, like, you know, it's just a leap of faith and grace will come. It's very sudden, you know. It's not about steady hard work and virtue.
Now, you mentioned that the pastor that you focused on in your article, Fernando Garay, was a loan officer for Bank of America, for its countrywide division.
Yes.
That seems incredible.
It is kind of incredible. And I think that, you know, in the immigrant community, he didn't even think of it as that remarkable. I mean, a lot of loan officers during the time of the loan boom, particularly sort of in Latin American and African American communities, were hired with not much experience. They weren't, you know, loan officers. They had never worked in a financial institution of any kind. They were charismatic figures in the community, you know, people who would be trusted to reach out to what were called emerging markets. And, you know, this is like the opposite of what we used to call the old redlining, where African Americans couldn't get loans. In this case, they really wanted to reach out to a kind of new community. And so they did connect with pastors who had some sway in the community. And in these kind of prosperity churches, part of what you teach your parishioners is kind of, you know, financial responsibility. And this all sounds sort of ironic and kind of backwards, but that's how it worked. You would go to these wealth seminars in which you'd learn about managing your money. And part of these wealth seminars were having loan officers who had some credibility in the community come and reach out and say, we're going to let you have access to the American dream. And who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want a house?
Hannah Rosen is contributing editor at The Atlantic Magazine. She'll be back in a minute to tell us more about the prosperity gospel and the housing market. And later in the show, Bhopal, India, 25 years after the world's worst industrial disaster. We'll be back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. That's music from prosperity gospel preacher Fernando Garay's church in Charlottesville, Virginia. Atlantic Magazine contributing editor Hannah Rosen joins us to talk about her article titled, Did Christianity Cause the Crash? And Hannah, you were telling us before the break about Fernando Garay, who, while he was growing his Casa del Padre church, he worked as a mortgage loan officer for Countrywide, and he would hold wealth-building seminars for his parishioners. You also found out that banks sought out charismatic minority leaders like Garay, and you noticed a connection between high foreclosure rates and areas where prosperity gospel churches are popular.
Yes, they took hold in two different kinds of communities. Both the rate of foreclosures and the growth of prosperity churches. And there were two different kind of geographical areas. One was urban and heavily ethnically homogenous neighborhoods, either Latin American or African American. The second was an exurban community that kind of popped up overnight, these sort of, you know, suburban exurban communities where all the houses were built around the same time. They were in the Sun Belt, a lot of them. And, you know, you can't draw an exact map because, we, as we all know, the foreclosures happened all over the place and Prosperity Church has had a long history in the South. But you can draw a vague map which shows that these two trends happened in common.
What does the bank say about using pastors like Fernando Garay to get, I guess, immigrant clients, really?
Well, this is subject of a lawsuit now, so they don't say very much. But I spoke to a woman who's a key witness in one of these lawsuits, and Countrywide has settled, by the way. But she described in great detail the process by which they would go to these wealth-building seminars and kind of give these talks. And, you know, people who have been to these seminars during that period have told me that the message was very mixed, that, like, you could go to one table and they would tell you something about sound financial investments, but all the symbolism of the conference would be about quick wealth. You know, there'd be posters of fancy cars and big houses and readily available riches, and so that you would go there and get really a mixed message.
Now, do people like Pastor Fernando Garay admit that there is this connection between the popularity of churches like his and a high foreclosure rate?
No, definitely not. And I really couldn't get them to talk about it or even talk about how the theology was kind of similar or fed each other. I mean, their view is that their church is protected, you know, that nobody in their church foreclosed, nobody in their church defaulted on a loan. Now, you know, that isn't true. People have financial troubles like anywhere else. There were certainly people in his congregation who were inspired by his teaching to go and take out loans, which they really couldn't afford. I mean, that definitely did happen. But he, you know, no, they don't really draw that connection. They don't see it as part of the same movement. The way he explains it is, look, I'm teaching them the power of investment, that you can invest in an idea and that will come back to you in some way. And that simple idea is very central to becoming an American and becoming prosperous.
So his parishioners, tell me, are they, I mean, do you see them being rewarded for believing and for making this investment?
For some, you know, there's a percentage of people who are very savvy, who tend to be men with children, let's say, you know, people who have more to lose, who really do learn a certain kind of sophistication about business practices. I quote an academic whose name is Tony Lin, who has spent a long time studying Latin American prosperity churches. And he says both of these things are true. There's some percentage of people who really do learn investment principles and become pretty sophisticated, basically because they have optimism and hope that they can tap into the American dream. They're not completely marginalized illegals, let's say. But then there's another percentage of people who just kind of, you know, it makes them do reckless things, like they're grasping after things that they can't afford, they shouldn't afford, they should take it easy, they shouldn't be spending all their money on sort of a cell phone, they shouldn't understand the American dream as purely in material terms, and they end up, you know, in big trouble.
What about some of the pastors involved here who are leading the prosperity gospel? It doesn't seem like they have any sort of common ground, common training. What do you think inspires them here? Is it prosperity?
I think actually that tends to be a common story. I think they are designed to be inspirational stories. I mean, this isn't true of Joel Osteen because he comes from a sort of line of well-known preachers. But in a lot of smaller prosperity churches, you do end up finding people whose testimony includes a time in their life/youth when they were extremely damaged. And this makes for a very compelling Christian testimony. I mean, the reason that people can relate to Fernando, even though he's kind of an American now, lives in a nice house, you know, has a lovely wife and children, is because he does have this story where he was once a drug dealer and, you know, he was abandoned by his mother and was raised on the streets and, you know, then just kind of saw the light and really, you know, got his act together. And I think that story is incredibly compelling to a lot of his parishioners.
What does Fernando Garay say about the economy now? Has his message changed because the economy's tanked?
Not in the way that you'd think. I mean, the prosperity gospel is kind of surprisingly alive and well in this era. And I think that's because it takes on a certain urgency. Like, the message is muted. They're not so brash in saying, like, you know, if you give me $10, you'll see $1,000 tomorrow. It doesn't quite work that way right now because we're not in that kind of free-flowing money environment. But they do say, you know, my church is protected. God is testing us now. It is ever more important that you show your faith. and you will ride out this terrible moment. And it's a time also when people really need hope. So I think the message has a life for that reason as well.
Was there anything that you heard when you were at his church that you found particularly surprising?
I think that having never sat in a church like that, you know, food multiplying in the refrigerator, that kind of concrete miracle that is promised is kind of surprising when you're sitting and listening to it, you know? And it must have an effect on people. And the kind of mixing of these kind of grand miracles and these very, you know, minor domestic details, food on the grill, food in the refrigerator, a check coming in the mail, your mortgage payment, elevated to this level of kind of, you know, miracle a minute is just kind of a very amazing and interesting combination.
Journalist Hannah Rosen's article is titled, Did Christianity Cause the Crash? It's published in the latest issue of The Atlantic magazine. Hannah, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, legendary newspaper man Harold Evans. We'll talk with him about his life in journalism from hot type to the digital age. That's tomorrow. The latest news is up next, Here and Now. Next week, there will be a lot of attention on Copenhagen, Denmark, as the United Nations climate change talks get underway there to try to figure out what to do about global warming when the international treaty known as the Kyoto Accord expires in 2012. The Danes have been spending more than a year getting ready for the event that may draw as many as 50,000 visitors to this small Scandinavian nation. The preparations include promoting Denmark as a role model for going green. Joining us is Katie Rice. She's a reporter with the Copenhagen Post. And Katie, can you tell us how the city's getting ready?
Sure. I was speaking with the deputy mayor of Copenhagen a few days ago, and he said one of his most interesting conversations he had was with the mayor of Kyoto. And the best advice that mayor gave him was to think about what your city is going to represent, what it's going to be linked to. So Copenhagen is very much decided that climate is going to be its thing. For example, obviously, you're probably aware cycling is a very big deal in Copenhagen anyway. In the last 10 years, they've increased the number of people on bikes by 10%. It's now 37%, and they want to get that up to 50 by 2015. So that's a lot of bikers.
And I heard that the city is actually taking steps and doing things like the Christmas tree on City Hall Square in Copenhagen. Can you describe what's going on with that?
Sure. The Christmas tree this year is going to be pedal-powered. So unless all the bicycles which are hooked up to the lights on the tree, and of course the lights are energy efficient, unless everybody is cycling one of the bikes, then all the lights on the Christmas tree won't light up. So there's been a lot of volunteers and just people generally walking by and thinking it's a good idea who've been hopping on a bike and getting involved.
So people can hop by on a bike that's connected to, what, some 7,000 lights on the tree, and that will power the lights so the tree lights up.
Exactly, yes.
And how are residents responding to this, to go green? Is it something they're proud of, or do they think it's kind of a pain or overdone, or what are they saying?
I think because Denmark itself, it's been very easy for it to adapt to the green scene, if you want to call it that. Companies have noticed they can make a lot of money off of this. You know, Denmark is one of the leading exporters and manufacturers of wind turbines in the world, so you know, the businesses are involved, the people themselves are involved. The government set up a very high publicized campaign called One Ton Less about 2 years ago, where they've been encouraging everyday residents to do something to reduce their carbon output by one ton a year. So everything from turning off the lights to taking showers instead of baths, even to eating in-season food so it doesn't have to be shipped from halfway around the world, all to try and do their bit.
Now, anyone who's been to Denmark is probably impressed with the wind turbines, with the economic growth in Denmark, and Denmark has been able to see that growth and keep energy consumption stable. But at the same time, it also its per capita emissions of carbon, that's one of the highest in the world, very dependent on coal. So there's a lot of irony here.
There is. While they will push the wind and say what a great thing it is, the politicians and the businesses here, they'll be the first to admit that they do have a heavy reliance on coal. I think it makes up about 50% of their energy needs right now. But at the same time, coming from where they were maybe 30, 40 years ago, the sustainable and renewable energy efforts have come leaps and bounds.
And from all reports, Katie, these talks next week probably won't produce something similar to what happened in Kyoto. There's not going to be any sort of Copenhagen Accord or anything like that. Do you think that will disappoint the folks in Denmark?
I don't think so. I mean, I think at least the politicians anyway, they just want to see an agreement at some point, whether it becomes known as the Copenhagen Accord or whether it gets another name after that next year. The people on the street, I think if they can keep the momentum up of being climate friendly or energy efficient, I think they're happy with that. And of course, you may be aware the IOC meeting and Congress, the Olympic Congress, was held here recently in October, which made the city of Copenhagen about $12 million in tourist revenue. So I'm sure there's a lot of hotel owners and bars and restaurants who are going to be quite happy that even if an agreement isn't reached here, they're still going to make some benefit from it.
All right. Katie Rice, a reporter with the Copenhagen Post, who's covering the United Nations climate change talks that begin in the Danish capital on Monday. Katie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And back in 30 seconds with a look at Bhopal, India, 25 years after the world's worst industrial disaster. It's here and now.
Good afternoon. Wednesday's headlines. The death toll continues to rise in the Indian gas disaster as many more bodies are found in neighboring towns. Rescue workers are now searching the dozen shanty towns.
On December 3, 1984, a gas cloud escaped from a chemical factory in Bhopal, India. The poison killed thousands of people. It was the world's worst industrial disaster. 5 years after the leak, the American company that owned the plant, Union Carbide, agreed to a nearly $500 million compensation deal with the Indian government. But some are still demanding that the company that bought Union Carbide, Dow Chemical, clean up the factory site and admit full responsibility for the leak. They protested in Bhopal today. Dow Chemical says the legal case was resolved with the 1989 settlement and that now all responsibility for the old factory site rests with the Indian government. The BBC's Alan Little just visited Bhopal. He says that while 25 years may have passed, the tragedy continues to dominate the lives of many residents.
Swarajpuri, urbane, eloquent, hospitable, tugs up a sleeve to reveal a series of little white scars on the inside of his left wrist. I can't remember, he says, how often they had to puncture the vein to measure the cyanide in my blood. It's amazing I'm still alive, I suppose. Mr. Puri was the police chief in the state of Madhya Pradesh that night. Roused from his bed after midnight, he made straight for the plant to find out what was going on, with still no notion of the scale of the catastrophe that was being unleashed. In the control room there was only one official, he told me, a very junior sort of a person. I asked him what had leaked and from where. He said he didn't know. Did he have any way to find out, I asked. He said no. Mr. Puri climbed to the highest part of the plant that night. It's probably what saved me, he said. The poisonous gas, methyl isocyanate, is heavier than air, so when it escaped from the plant, it settled in a dense cloud and moved silently through the poor neighbourhoods around the plant. I could see, he said, the black density of the poisonous cloud making its slow progress through the dimly lit streets. 25 years on, Mrs. Hazara B. remembers the bodies lying in the streets, the suddenness of it, people leaping from their beds and dying in their nightclothes. There was a dairy over there, she says. All the buffaloes were dead. We ran in terror. Imagine the terrible randomness, the whim of it, the direction of the wind determining whether you lived or died. Hazara B. is indefatigable in her thirst for redress. She petitions, she marches, she clambers onto the cheap compartments of the night train to Delhi to lead a demonstration at the headquarters of Dow Chemical, the company that bought Union Carbide. Hazara B. is still waiting, she says, for justice. In 1989, the Indian government reached an out-of-court settlement with Union Carbide. The company paid $470 million in compensation. This represented the insurance value plus interest. The Indian government had initially demanded almost 10 times that amount. The money agreed was enough to build a hospital for those who survived, but would never work again. 500,000 people were exposed to the gas. Each would get about $1,000 in compensation. The deal also represented a full and final settlement of Union Carbide's liabilities. For Dow Chemical, the matter is now closed. It is not, however, a closed matter for the people of the affected areas. There is a small, very special group of people who are vital to our trade of reporting the difficult places of the world. They are known to us as local fixers, and without them, we reporters would not be able to do our jobs. Our local fixer in Bhopal is called Sanjay. This is his story. He was 5 months old on the night of the gas, the youngest of eight brothers and sisters. My 11-year-old sister picked me up and wrapped me in a blanket and ran from the gas, he said. The family had gone to bed that night as usual. When the sun came up the next morning, Sanjay's mother, his father, and five of his seven siblings were dead. Sanjay would grow up in an orphanage. Sanjay's sole surviving brother, Sunil, was 13 that night. Later, as an adult, Sunil joined a charitable organisation called Sambhavna as a full-time organiser and campaigner, travelling in Europe and the United States, as well as in India, to raise awareness and funds. With the compensation they eventually received, he and Sanjay bought an apartment, and Sanjay moved out of the orphanage and back to what was left of his family. But Sunil never fully recovered from the night of the gas. 3 years ago, when Sanjay was away in Delhi, Sunil, alone in their shared flat, committed suicide at the age of 35. Sanjay is a bright, funny, charming man with an irrepressible joie de vivre. But the world's worst industrial disaster has shaped him. Bereavement has walked with him through his life. Mr. Puri, the police chief, arrested Union Carbide's American chairman, Warren Anderson, a few days after the disaster. Mr. Anderson was released on bail and allowed to fly home to the United States, where he lives in retirement. No one has ever been successfully prosecuted for what happened at Bhopal. There is a tremendous frustration among the people that there has been no justice, says Mr. Puri. I feel it too. On December the 3rd each year I go quietly to the place where we buried a lot of the children, just to remember, he says, and to pray.
Reflections from the BBC's Alan Little on the 25th anniversary of the Bhopal industrial disaster. Well, you have to admit, the man's got stamina. Russia's Prime Minister Vladimir Putin answered questions for 4 hours on Russian television and radio today. He used the appearance to send one of his strongest signals yet that he may run for Russia's top office again in 2012. Putin said, "I will think about it. There's still enough time," when he was asked whether he'll run in the next presidential election. "Don't hold your breath," he told another person who asked whether he was planning to leave politics. Some 2 million questions were submitted to Putin by phone or over the internet. Russia's current president, Dmitry Medvedev, is in Rome today. Medvedev said he and Putin will reach agreement to avoid elbowing each other before the next election. And this reminder, you can listen to our show stream live on our website, hereandnow.org, or you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's hereandnow.org. And before we go today, the man who collects the world's secrets. You're listening to Here and Now. On Capitol Hill today, the head of the House Homeland Security panel said the nation is lucky that the security breach at a state dinner did not result in, quote, a night of horror. Mississippi Democrat Congressman Benny Thompson spoke before the start of a hearing by his panel into how Tariq and Mikhail Salahi were able to get into the dinner for the Prime Minister of India last week without an invitation. Secret Service Director Mark Sullivan, the only witness at the hearing, told the panel that mistakes were made, but he also said President Obama was never at risk.
Although these individuals went through magnetometers and other levels of screening, Their entry into the White House is unacceptable and indefensible.
The House Homeland Security Committee still wants to talk with the Salahis and to White House Social Secretary Desiree Rogers. All three were invited to appear today, but declined. Question. Do you have a secret, something nobody else knows? Here's an example.
I am a Southern Baptist pastor's wife, and no one knows that I do not believe in God.
Or this one.
I haven't seen you since we broke up, but I still read your horoscope every morning, and I always hope you have a good day.
These are just a couple of the 400,000 postcards from around the world that Frank Warren received. Warren started collecting secrets in 2004, and he has a website and now a new book called Post Secret: Confessions on Life, Death, and God. Forbes has called him the most trusted stranger in America. And Frank Warren joins us now from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Frank.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
Well, the most trusted stranger in America. How does that feel?
I don't know about that. You have to ask my daughter.
How old is she?
She's 15.
Oh, yeah. She doesn't trust you.
Well, she told me once what her favorite secret was that she saw on a postcard. And it was one that said, "People think I've stopped lying, but I've just gotten better at it." So at least she told me that. I think that's a good sign.
That's great to hear from your 15-year-old, right?
Right.
Now, this book, while we may be laughing about it, and there are certainly some light things in here, there are also some very dark things.
Well, you're right. The secrets just hit every note of human emotion. They can be funny. They can be joyful or sexual or hopeful or heavy. One on the website right now, down at the bottom, this one was sent to me through an email. They took a picture of their postcard, and the picture has a faded old photograph of a mother and a very young child, and the secret's written on the card, and it reads, "When I discovered my estranged mother's blog, I began making anonymous comments there, hoping she'd realize it's me." And when I read a secret like that, it just makes me aware of these, you know, everyday stories that we never get a chance to see.
Have you ever gotten a postcard that you felt like you had to do something about?
Well, almost all the postcards arrive anonymously, but some of them are very heavy and they carry painful secrets. And when I get those, what I try and do is channel those feelings towards promoting 1-800-SUICIDE, a national suicide prevention hotline on the website. And in fact, in 5 years, the post-secret community has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for Hopeline.
You know, one person wrote that they stopped mailing their secrets to you because they didn't want them to end up in one of your books. Do you get that kind of reaction? Or overall, what would you say the reaction is that you get from folks who do then see their secrets published?
I think some people are thrilled. Some people are terrified. I've had some people say that when they wrote down their secret on the card, they felt like they were making something up. But then when they took it to the mailbox, physically let it go, and then later saw it on the website, they realized that there was a kernel of truth there. And the whole process was a way for them to share a secret with themselves that they'd been hiding from.
We read one that said, "I'm a Christian who's falling in love with someone who doesn't believe in God."
And I think it's a beautiful love story is how that one ends. I like that coda. That's probably the most common kind of secret I get. And what I mean by that is this idea that so many of us are on a journey trying to find that one person who we can share all of our secrets with. I know I probably get a handful of those every day in the 200 or so that arrive in my mailbox.
I read this one that said, "I'd rather this cancer," and it's a picture of what looks like cells, "kill him than face the overwhelming sadness that our 14-year marriage is failing." I mean, these are very, very powerful. Another one here says, "Until about 3 years ago, I couldn't understand what kind of person my father had to be to cheat on my mom. I still don't understand what kind of person it takes. I just know I'm one of them."
Yeah, a secret. I mean, so much can be said on a postcard. At the same time, it's kind of incomplete. And so it invites readers to maybe kind of finish the story in a way that makes sense to them. And that, I hope, creates a greater sense of empathy between strangers.
Were you surprised when you first started doing this?
I was stunned that people would trust me with such deep secrets, and also the artwork that came on the postcards. Each one has a photograph, a drawing, a design, a collage, and each one being made by someone who didn't consider themselves an artist.
And I understand that you also have a secret. from when you were in high school, which may, in part at least, have led to your fascination with secrets.
That's right. When I was in high school, I attended a very fundamentalist church, and two or three nights a week I was at service, and at the end of service I was praying for the gift of the Holy Ghost. Evidence of is speaking in tongues, and this went on for probably 2 years, and I never showed evidence of that. I never actually got to that point where I spoke in a different language. I spoke with a new tongue. And for years, I felt like a failure, like there was something I had done wrong. But then later in life, after post-secret, I came to the understanding that in some ways, people were finding a way to speak using these short missives and creative artwork in a way that they kind of had a different tongue. And I felt like I was finding my voice through these strangers whose postcards were arriving in my mailbox, and I could share them back with everyone.
Why did you start collecting secrets?
I think part of it was when I was younger. I was an only child for a while, and I just imagined other people had these funny inside jokes or desires or hopes or fears that they might not share with others. And I felt if I could create a safe, non-judgmental place where people could share those feelings, it could really be something special. But I wasn't prepared for 7 million visitors around the world coming and reading the secrets every month.
There are a lot of secrets out there in the world.
Well, after seeing almost 400,000, you would think that, you know, they'd be the same or they'd be very similar. But every day they're full of surprises, almost like, you know, poems or songs. I don't think we ever run out of them. They're inexhaustible.
Frank Warren, author of Post Secret, Confessions on Life, Death, and God. He's also founder of the website postsecret.com. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
No, it's been a great pleasure.